Welcome back here on Can't Wait. And while we're big sports fans here, we're also huge music fans because we're broadcasting this thing on KXCI.org. We obviously care about music. And the thing about music is that there's often an artist that has a lot of albums out and a couple of them might not quite hit the same way. You know, somebody like a Bob Dylan. How many albums does Bob Dylan have at this point?
130.
130 albums. He's got a couple stinkers in there, but among those stinkers, there are fans of those stinkers. And each of us here has an album by a band or an artist that didn't quite hit the way it normally would with the public, but it means something to us. So we're calling this segment Defend an Album. What's an album out there that maybe didn't get the critical or commercial love you thought it deserved or flew under the radar, or you maybe just want some people to check it out? We'll start with you, Rusty.
Okay, so I did this, and this time I don't have a story about how I got to it.
I know.
Surprise. I was kind of counting on it.
I know. I figured you were. But I did think about it. I listen to a lot of acclaimed music and stuff that gets really great, you know, reviews and is really considered just very good.
It you was have top-notch to taste.
Yeah. Thanks. That's what I was trying to say.
That was really his whole point. He doesn't have an album to share.
Everything I like is great.
As I have such impeccable taste, my album I'm defending is obviously Weird Al's album.
Oh, that's there you go.
Weird Al Yankovic.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, one of the greats to ever do it. I have a lot of positive things to say about Weird Al.
I'm sure. I mean, there's a ton to say that is great about him. I was looking on AllMusic and just their ratings to get a sense, to make sure I wasn't thinking of an album. And his Running with Scissors album is from 1999.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that one.
That album got 2.5 stars mm-hmm. out of 5. And I feel like that's not really fair. He is given a lot of credit on AllMusic. His In 3D CD or album is 4.5 stars. Off the Deep End, the Nevermind parody with the mm-hmm. Nevermind parody mm-hmm. is 4.5. Mandatory Fun that came out last year is 4 stars.
Yeah.
But Running with Scissors is only 2.5. And just for The Saga Begins alone,
it's great.
It's an amazing album.
And that's one of his best sellers, that record.
It is. It was a very good seller. What you may not know is Don McLean says he's messed up the lyrics of American Pie on stage because of that song.
That's great.
His grandkids like that song so much, The Saga Begins, and so does my son, and so do my nephews. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's an amazing song. And one thing that song does, too, is Weird Al, his voice, he's amazing despite his voice, right? He's able to be a musician and sing despite his voice. He plays up the badness.
He sings out of his nose, but on perfect pitch.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah,
in this song, he actually sings and sounds nice, and it's pleasant sounding, you know? And so he can do more. I'm saying he's more than just a one-trick pony, and that's obvious to any Weird Al fan. You don't really have to defend that to Weird Al fans, but to my wife, I always have to defend it.
Well, think about this. How many parody artists have come and gone with one hit? You know, that is a genre that almost predisposes you to being here today, gone tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has been the king of this since the early 80s.
Yeah.
He's been doing this for 30 plus years. That's amazing. We will never see that again.
No, not at parody level. And he goes beyond it because on this album, Running with Scissors, he also did his own material. It wasn't all just parody. And he's done that, I think, a couple other times,
too. A lot of his records will be like half parody songs, then a couple genre pastiches where he'll like do like a polka thing where he runs through a ton of pop hits.
That's
and then there'll be about 4 or 5 originals on every record.
Yeah.
And they're all very funny.
I really enjoy Albuquerque. I have to defend that to my wife, the way the album ends. And it's not brilliant, but it's always Weird Al doing his postmodern take on stuff mm-hmm. that's so wonderful and amazing in that he does it without being mean. He does the polka parody songs, and he makes fun of those songs just by using the lyrics against them, right? And it doesn't mm-hmm. matter who it is. It's Marilyn Manson, or it's Matchbox 20, or it's Hanson, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, and I think he does it without being mean because he loves pop culture so much, mm-hmm. right? And so he is able to turn it in on itself in such a sweet and wonderful, fun way that I can share it with anybody, grandma, or...
There's no cynicism.
No.
And it's incredible to be in the field of comedy and not cynical for 3+ decades and be as successful as he has with all the Grammys that he has and still be current. Like, if you've seen any of his recent videos where he parodies a who did he parody recently? Like, he
Perry
did Lord.
Farrell.
He's still with it today.
Sure.
And he's had to adapt to the YouTube culture where, you know, a parody can happen the day a song comes out.
Right.
It doesn't, like, in the heyday of Weird Al, he had an album cycle where he could gather a bunch of ideas. But now he's had to adapt to where he's got to answer the call that day, release these singles within the month. Mm-hmm. Because what's more dated right now than, like, that Lord hit, Royals? I mean, that feels like it came out 40 years ago.
Yeah.
But he's been able to navigate these waters as a parody artist and a comedian while remaining the undisputed king of the genre. He's amazing.
And his stage performances, I hear, are amazing. I've never seen him live. I would love to.
It's like this beautiful family event.
Yeah. I saw him around that time, actually, when that album came out. He played in Tucson. And I would have been in, you know, probably like fifth grade or something, like right in the Weird Al fan sweet spot.
Yeah, Weird Al.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, he played The Saga Begins, and it was right around the time that The Phantom Menace was coming out. And it was such... It was one of my most memorable concert experiences because it was like when you expect to see like a Madonna or someone like that where there's going to be elaborate costume changes and sets and all that. He did all that. I mean, he was doing a costume change for every song, and he'd have, you know, these big like videos in the background and just a great performer. I would recommend it to anybody, especially if you have kids. But even so, like, you can check your cynicism at the door. It's just a great concert experience.
Do you remember last year when there was an online movement to try to get him to play halftime of the Super Bowl?
Yes, no, but that would
absolutely
be amazing.
It would be amazing, right?
It'd be all time.
What would be better than that? What would be more culturally relevant than having Weird Al make fun of pop culture in the middle of the Super Bowl? I mean, that's
it would
so
be an incredible show. It would be family friendly. It would be funny in a way that isn't trying too hard to be funny. Like, whenever you see those kind of like silly things at the halftime show, like Katy Perry and the Sharks and whatever, this would be perfect. And I have nothing but love and respect for Weird Al. He is an all-timer. He's going down in history as one of the greats to ever do it.
Yep. I would just want to point out too, real quickly, my baby's in love with Eddie Vedder is on that album, which is very fun.
Yes.
Your horoscope for today, where he makes fun of astrology, which that's something I can really get behind, is making fun of astrology.
Yeah.
And he does it in such a brilliant way where it's so super specific and absurdly so that horoscopes can never be that. And he makes fun of it brilliantly that way. And All About the Pentiums is really great in that it almost ushered in like nerd culture a little bit, where All About the Pentiums, it's dated now because it is about computer stuff that, you know, was the turn of the century.
Yeah. And it's weirdly dated because that kind of hip hop doesn't, like, Chamillionaires, that kind of beat doesn't get made anymore.
No.
So
no,
it's a moment in time, but a perfect moment in time.
It is. It's perfect. It's perfect. And he pulls it off with such aplomb, and he almost sounds like Frank Zappa at times in that song to me. And I really appreciate just all of his influences and all the pop culture that he turns inside out. And so I defend Running with Scissors by Weird Al Yankovic.
100%.
Good choice. Yeah, good choice.
What about you, Matt?
Well, you know, it's a tough question because I think that you got to figure out something that obviously you like, but that if you're defending it, it must mean that there's something people don't like about it.
Or it's something like somebody, like the cool guy at the record store would make fun of you.
And that's kind of how I decided to go with it. I tried to picture it from like the what's the record that you would have been kind of embarrassed to bring up at your like judgmental record store.
Jack Black and High Fidelity is going to laugh you out of the door.
Exactly. And that's why I ultimately went with the Green Album by Weezer.
Okay. Because it's not cool.
Every Weezer album since Pinkerton is uncool.
Yes.
But the Green Album holds a special place for Weezer fans because it was the sort of turning point moment in the Weezer's relationship to kind of pop culture and music in general. You know, for your little 3-second history of Weezer here, you know, as people know, Weezer forms, puts out the Blue Album. It's an instant classic, huge success, big
like
commercial
quadruple
success.
Platinum.
Yeah, huge
the
hit.
Buddy Holly video is part of culture.
Yep, and it's a critically acclaimed album. So good on you, Weezer.
It's Rick Ocasek.
Exactly. Yep. Then they come out with Pinkerton couple years later, and Pinkerton is one of the all-time examples of, you know, underappreciated albums that gain a new life years later. It's a flop when it comes out, critically and commercially, And it basically is such a flop that it causes Weezer to essentially break up, go on hiatus.
Rivers Cuomo has like a mental meltdown.
Mental breakdown. He goes off to Harvard.
Like Rolling Stone called it the worst record of the year, which is insane because it, I mean, just with a critical set of, if you're just not rooting against him, you just listen to that record. It's like a half decent Pavement album.
Right.
It's really pretty good. There's catchy stuff. There's problematic stuff in Across the Sea that is weird to listen to. Yeah. But like El Scorcho is a catchy tune.
Oh, I love Pinkerton, and yeah. I would defend Pinkerton if it didn't already have tons of defenders.
It's like Office Space. Office Space tanked at the box office, but that's one of the all-time comedy classics.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, the cult of Weezer grows over the years. They take this 3-year hiatus. Most people expect that they'll probably never come back. And then they announce that they are returning, that Rivers is coming back to music. And there's a lot of anticipation and hope for
and joyful tears among the Pinkerton cult.
Exactly. Because Pinkerton, I mean, it became one of the defining albums of what would later become emo.
100%.
It had, you know, tremendous influence on a certain type of fan. And in particular, those who really grew very attached to how insanely personal the album was. I mean, the thing that makes it hard to listen to and embarrassing at points is that it basically is just... It reads like pages from a diary that have just been set to music. And you know, that makes it awkward at times, but it also, you know, it makes it feel very personal. And that there's no one but Rivers who could have written those words and you know...
Make them that catchy.
Yeah, and still make them catchy. So then the Green Album comes out, and people, you know, have in their mind kind of what their relationship with Pinkerton and the Blue Album was. Which are both very confessional, personal albums. And the Green Album comes out, and it is just 10 totally generic, super catchy pop songs where all of the lyrics are, you know, completely detached from any, like, individual person's experience.
Anybody could have written it.
Anybody could have written these lyrics. But these are all super catchy, great songs, in my opinion.
It's a Cars record. Ultimately that Rick Ocasek influence coming in, and it's they're anthems.
Yeah, and you know what? Those Cars songs, like, I'm sorry, but most of those songs lyrically are not all that complex.
No.
You know,
no.
They're pretty generic.
And that's
and
why they're hits.
And that's why they're hits. So what people didn't realize is that in those years on hiatus, Rivers was not trying to figure out, like, okay, well, how do I do the Blue Album and Pinkerton but better? He was trying to figure out, like, well, that didn't work. What can I do that will work? And it's so kind of crassly, like, commercial that I think people found it very off-putting that it seemed so calculated that they were trying to have mainstream success. But I think it's a credit to what a brilliant sort of pop mind he had that he was able to come back and reinvent himself and put this album out that, even if the songs are sort of generic in their thematic and lyrical content, are all incredibly catchy. And another thing that's kind of that's commonly reviled or criticized about the album is that every single song on the album has the exact same structure.
Yes.
Like, and there's even been the term coined of the Green Album solo, which is when you just have the verse melody as a guitar solo in the bridge. And every song on the album has that pretty much. But I think there's something sort of brilliant and simple about that, about this idea that, like, I am going to break pop music down to its simplest building blocks in chunks that anybody can immediately digest. And you know what? I think it's their catchiest album. I still listen to it now. I think there are Weezer albums that have been released since then that are defensible as well, even though they've obviously had some really catastrophic failures. I think their last album was actually a really good record that kind of got... underappreciated.
People don't trust him anymore.
Yeah, nobody takes Weezer seriously anymore among serious fans. I mean, they still have commercial success and they can play big shows and all that. But Everything Will Be All Right in the End, actually, I think, has a lot of really good songs on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think among, like, serious Weezer fans, Maladroit is considered to be, you know, the best of the post-Pinkerton albums. But I'm here today to tell you that if you're reflexively rejecting the Green Album because of what it stands for, sort of just... check your cynicism at the door. Listen to 10 great pop songs that are super catchy that you'll be humming for the rest of the day and for many days after that.
I think it's a fascinating record in that was his response to what happened after Pinkerton. It's a defense mechanism. He put out the most personal thing imaginable, and he was rejected for it.
Mm-hmm.
He was completely rejected. I mean, can you imagine anything more devastating than pouring your heart out after you've gained this platform and then to hear, no, that was wrong. What you did was wrong. And so he retreats into writing perfect songs about nothing.
Yeah.
So when you think of it in that context, wow, it's like an extension of Pinkerton where it's like, okay, well, I just tried to tell, because like, Pinkerton's like trying to tell the girl you've always had a crush on, you know, here's how I feel about you. Honestly, you know, warts and all. Mm-hmm. And she says, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And like savages him in front of, and like almost rejects him in front of the entire high school. Like mm-hmm. it's like a bad movie.
Right.
And then so he goes to college. He comes back. He doesn't tell anyone anything about himself. And he's kind of this mysteriously cool guy at the party who has this perfectly manicured life. But you don't know about what happened to get him there. Mm-hmm. So you listen to the Green Album on the surface and you're hearing like, oh, this guy's got a nice apartment. All of his furniture matches.
Right.
It's math. But no, there's hurt underneath there.
Oh, yeah.
And so to think of like the most perfectly calculated pop album coming out of this place of complete rejection, I mean, there isn't a more fascinating thing to me than the arc of Weezer through that period. Mm-hmm. Now I jump off at Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
That's where I kind of leave the party. But that stretch, I think, is completely fascinating.
And if you have not invested a couple listens in Everything Will Be All Right in the End, it's legitimately a good album. It was probably one of my 10 favorite albums last year.
There's guitar solos on that thing that'll just singe the hair off your neck.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds kind of like Maladroit in some regards, but I think it has almost no embarrassing songs on it, which you can't say about any other post Maladroit album.
True.
and I think it has, you know, it's like he's one thing you have to give Rivers credit for is that in these late years where he, you know, has sort of lost the critical adoration, one thing he has not lost is that he's still, in his own weird way, incredibly ambitious and creative.
100%.
And he still does things that no other pop songwriter does. And a lot of it doesn't work. But he has, if you are willing to sort through the trash, you can put together a 10 or 12 song mixtape of post-Maladroit songs that are really, really phenomenal power pop songs.
And he's got a strong bass. Mm-hmm. He's able to do all of these departures and detours because his bass never leaves.
Yeah. Yeah, Weezer fans are pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's a dedicated group. So for the album I'm going to defend, it's from a defenseless band. We're going to go back to 1992, the year that grunge is king. We have the Seattle Mount Rushmore of grunge artists, your Nirvana, your Pearl Jam, your Soundgarden, your Alice in Chains. The whole time this is happening, you also have weirdo, experimental, kind of aggressively strange bands like Mudhoney selling a lot of records. And this is a time where thoughtful rock music, whether or not you were a fan of it, you know, a band like Pearl Jam has its aesthetic problems for some people because their frontman seems like he's got a mouthful of marbles. But that was a band that had that was on the right side of a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. Nirvana, you know, they were able to take aggressively weird punk-inspired music and sell it to a lot of people, but with a, you know, pretty thick studio sheen, never mind as a studio record, but they were able to break through in a way that no other rock band has since and probably never will. Mm-hmm. So we're at this point now where rock music matters culturally, and when that happens, you have a lot of opportunists come along, a lot of people that don't have the goods, but they need to sound like what the radio sounds like in order to achieve their very high ambitions. One such band was Stone Temple Pilots. Core is one of the worst records I've ever heard. Uh-huh. That was probably the worst record I ever owned, because at the time, as a dummy trying to get into rock music, that's all I had access to. I'm living in Wyoming, so whatever comes to me has to be popular, right? I eventually find my way to the cool stuff, but in order to get there from cultural isolation, you have to pass through Stone Temple Pilots.
Right.
You do. I'm from Indiana. I get it.
So that record Core is indefensible. Sex Type Thing, the single, that was a single, mind you.
Yeah.
That song's a felony.
Yeah.
If you listen to that song.
Oh, yeah.
And especially in the context of men's rights today.
Right.
That's a horrifying piece of garbage.
Yeah.
Wicked Garden was a single. Mm-hmm. This is not. people make fun of Jim Morrison for being brain dead dumb with his like dumb handsome guy poetry that is just laughably bad. Scott Weiland was even dumber, and he sang in this way that was so clearly a put on. You know, that ha 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 way that he sang, like a braying donkey that couldn't quite get the phlegm out of his throat.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to sound like Eddie Vedder, because that's what all those low-rent grunge guys were trying to sing like Eddie Vedder. Candlebox did the same thing. There was this whole subgenre of Pearl Jam that just didn't get it, but thought they did. They got it in the wrong way.
Yeah.
Stone Temple Pilots got it completely wrong with Core, but that record sold about 10 million copies. What I remember most about Core, this is at a time when Sam Goody was king,
mm-hmm.
and they used to have enough money to run TV ads for albums.
Wow.
And Plush by Stone Temple Pilots was one of the ads they would run, because that was one of the biggest songs that year.
Yeah. Oh, it's one of the biggest songs of that era, without a doubt.
It's still just a... It's if you're making a movie about 1992, 93, you're probably going to use Plush during, like, one of the high school dances.
Right.
Yeah.
So they have now ascended to the top commercially among these other bands that might have had a more defined artistic point of view. Then comes Purple. Purple's a little better. Interstate Love Song is okay.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting to soften some of those dumb edges, but it's still pretty dumb.
Like, Scott Weiland started writing words that made sense.
Yeah, there was more of an artistic point of view, but not really. Like, Interstate Love Song's a catchy tune. That comes on the radio, I'll hum along.
Oh yeah.
But there's still stuff like Meat Plow, which is like stuck in the mud. I mean, it's just awful garbage. So we are now setting the stage for 1996. We have these two plotting, kind of dumb, like jock rock albums. So they come out with Tiny Music, Songs from the Vatican Gift Shop. And when this record came out, all the dumb, plotting, idiot fans of Stone Temple Pilots are like, what is this garbage? What am I even listening to? And it's by far their least successful record commercially. It's, if you go to a used CD store, you're going to see a lot of copies of Tiny Music Songs for the Vatican Gift Shop.
It does have a very iconic album cover.
It does.
It's very bright. Uh-huh. It's very colorful.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, if you're at a used CD store and you see Tiny Music Songs for the Vatican Gift Shop for sale for about $1.50, which is, I think, the going rate,
mm-hmm.
pick it up. It's pretty good. And that's the record I'm here to defend. Tiny Music Songs for the Vatican Gift Shop sounds nothing like Stone Temple Pilots. Scott Weiland sings in his natural singing voice, which is actually kind of a pretty high tenor. This mm-hmm. reedy voice. The songs are still dumb, but they're dumb in a T-Rex way.
Right.
You know, it's a glam record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Big Bang Baby comes out. It's this, like, I remember the video hitting and we're like, this is Stone Temple. What? Who are these guys? And they're doing like this T-Rex, Mark Bolan sort of thing. They've glammed up. The guitars sound different. There's more mid-range in it. There's more reverb in it. They've eased the compression off slightly, which was the knob that killed 90s rock.
Yeah.
Everybody turned that compression all the way up to smash all the instruments into the same sonic space.
Yeah.
This record has a little room to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot. I'm not going to tell you it's the best record you've ever heard, but it's pretty good. And there's a song on their Lady Pitcher Show, which is really nice. Tripping on a Hole in a Paper Heart is kind of an okay song.
Mm-hmm.
That's a record you can put on. I mean, there's a couple duds, but for the most part, if that record were to come out today by just some like Pitchfork buzz band, just some brand new thing,
mm-hmm.
and this record comes out, I think it would get good reviews. I think it would be accepted critically.
Mm-hmm.
I think those songs are catchier than a lot of the rock songs that you hear come out from bands today.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the bands that get a lot of the coverage, like let's say the Black Keys put this record out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be respected. Maybe not beloved, but I think it would be respected.
And it would be Grammy nominated because it was put by
default.
The Black Keys. Yeah.
By default. But I do think that there would be a place for this record in 2015's rock, whatever rock music is now.
Uh-huh.
And I do think that they had a weird gift for melody, even in those plotting dumb garbage records.
Yeah.
There's melodies that weasel their way into you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's probably the most glaring example of past returns does not indicate future performance. Because if you're going to tell me the third Stone Temple Pilots record is actually going to be kind of good after what has to be my least favorite record of all time. Mm-hmm. Core is my least favorite record of all time.
It's really bad.
It's bad in a way that is so, it's grating sonically, mm-hmm. but then it's also clearly where your Seven Mary Threes and your Puddle of Muds and mm-hmm. all of the terrible late 90s rock, your yeah. Creed.
Yeah.
It all goes back to Core.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I kind of feel bad about myself for having owned it.
I do too.
You know what I mean? Like, I listen
guilty.
To it in cars and stuff, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I apologize. I probably put a song of that on that record for a mixtape I was trying to make a girl I like.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know why it didn't work. Because listen to the way this guy sang. It was awful. Nobody sings like that anymore.
Right.
Because it's laughably bad. Mm-hmm. But in 1992, that's the way you got on MTV.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, well, you know, so Tiny Music also, it has the distinct pleasure of having been produced by my least favorite producer of all time.
Oh, he's terrible. Yeah, Brendan O'Brien?
The worst.
The worst.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, I'm a big Springsteen fan, and I think that Springsteen still writes really good songs today, but he's had a couple of albums in recent years that have been ruined by Brendan O'Brien's production.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, just destroyed. When even the songs themselves are good songs, and in a live setting they sound cool, and you know, he's still able to, he hasn't lost it, you know, he can still do good stuff. But Brendan O'Brien, for whatever reason, he's kind of fascinated by him, and he is...
He loves treble.
Yeah. Yes.
And for whatever
Here comes
reason,
treble.
Yeah, that treble knob helped Stone Temple Pilots out because mm-hmm. they were so bogged down in the muck of like pseudo grunge.
Yeah,
they almost needed somebody that was too bright to bring them to someplace listenable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this weird circumstance where two of the worst come together to produce something kind of okay.
Yeah. Huh.
And so I don't love this record, but I'm gonna say if you haven't heard it, it's worth hearing because I don't think you're going to expect it to sound the way it does.
Okay. I'm ready to go back and listen to that. And I'll go you one further. Is Scott Weiland in 98 released his first solo album?
Oh, 12 Bar Blues?
12 Bar Blues. That's not the worst thing at all.
That's an insane record. That's a record by an insane person.
It is. But I still think that it's worth a listen. I'm ready to go back and take a listen to it. I think, he's crazy. And I mean, I wish him well. I hope he gets
pulls
well
through.
And stuff. And
yeah.
if that can happen for him,
I'm not.
Exactly.
No, yeah.
And again, it's not an album that I was all that happy to share with my friends, but I picked it up and I did end up sharing it with my friends because I was like, this isn't terrible.
Yeah, it's weird. But it's weird in an interesting way.
Yeah.
In a way that Stone Temple Pilots early, they were most definitely not weird. You know, they were very traditional. They were very successful.
They were making money off a genre.
Yes. They were piggybacking.
Yeah.
But this is that solo record has a song about the movie Barbarella.
Yeah.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. That was the lead single. This was a time in culture where the disgraced frontman of one of the worst bands of the 90s could come out and write a song about a movie from the 60s and lead his solo record with it.
His marketing was led with.
I miss the 90s, honestly, because I don't think culture is as weird as it could be. Like, right now, everything, as fragmented as it is, it's still very predictable. Weird stuff doesn't break out the way it used to. And I just don't, I can't even imagine a scenario. There's not a 2015 equivalent to Scott Weiland writing a song about Barbarella. I miss it.
At least not that's getting put out on a major label. It may exist on Bandcamp somewhere but everyone's ignoring it.
Yeah, it's not. But that was on MTV.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, that video was on rotation. Not heavy rotation, but rotation. It was around. So we're at a spot now where I just feel like everything is, I don't know, everything has its 400 fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that kind of reduces the level of weirdness that can make it big. They're still weird, but it's weird for the weirdos. I kind of miss the days when something could be aggressively bad, tank, and come back with something like that.
Yeah.
That's nice to share.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to go back and listen to Weezer's Green Album, too. I'm definitely going to be listening to that later today.
It's really, really catchy. I need water. I've somehow lost my voice.
All right. Well, that's a sign that we're going to turn out the lights, I guess, right?
What happened here? Okay. I got really emotional talking about Scott Weiland.
Scott Weiland does that to a lot of people.
And I left my water bottle in the car. So that's going to do it here for Can't Wait. Because I literally can't talk anymore.
He's leaving it all out on the court.
Yeah, this is LeBron's cramp game.
Yeah.
So, what do you got going on, locals only, Matt?
Well, tomorrow night, which is Monday, I've got my friends in the Pigpen Theater Company, who are actually not a Tucson-based group, but one of their members grew up in Tucson, is an old friend of mine, and they've had outstanding success out in the world, and they're coming through town. Actually, tonight they're playing at Club Congress,
yeah.
But they're going to spend a couple days in town before they move on to the next stop along the road. So thought I'd bring them down to Locals Only. They're really cool, both theater group and band. There'll be a band on this tour, but they also do like original productions.
I love that music video, Bremen.
Oh, it's
amazing. I saw
that.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible stuff.
Yeah. So,
really looks fun.
Mm-hmm. What do you got going on, Rusty?
Matt Baquet from Club Congress is going to be my special guest DJ next week. We're going to do something a little bit different than we've done in the past. He's going to pre-record something. We're going to play it for about 20 minutes. We'll talk about what he's doing. That sort of thing.
Very cool.
Awesome.
I got my voice back.
Hey.
The podcast this week is going to have Gamma Like Very Ultra.
Cool.
We talked to the three of them, and we're going to have some tracks off their new album. I think their release show is June 27th at the Solar Culture.
Yep.
White Light, and who else is playing that show? I don't remember. No. It's going to be great. Just go anyway. So that's going to do it here for us on Can't Wait, and we're going to keep doing this until someone tells us not to.